Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Robert Smith. Let me tell you a secret about being a reporter. If it were not for deadlines, reporters like myself would work on the same story for the rest of our lives. The only way we get things done around here is deadlines. But it does mean that sometimes you don't have a real ending to the story you're telling. You just have to sort of figure out some kind of way to end the podcast. Now, oftentimes, I will admit this, oftentimes we sort of end with a kind of time will tell, but not today. Today on the show, time has told. We follow up on our favorite stories of the year, and we find out what happened after we turned off our recorders, after the deadline. It's an annual tradition we have here at Planet Money, named after a certain catchphrase of the radio legend Paul Harvey.
Today, together, you and I are going to learn the rest of the story.
The reason why this is my favorite time of year is because I get to do my Paul Harvey impression. This is the rest of the story for 2016.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Atlassian. Today, nearly anything is possible, and if we can dream it, teams can build it. So how do you bring everyone together to realize their shared vision? With Atlassian, makers of software for teams. Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket give your team everything you need to organize, discuss, and complete shared work. Atlassian works to help teams large and small ascend to new heights to create what's next. Visit Atlassian.com. Atlassian, team up.
I'll tell you, this is not an easy year to recap because most of the big, scary economic stories that we covered all year long still don't have endings to them. They're still teetering on the edge. The United Kingdom, for instance, the United Kingdom still has not pulled the trigger to leave the European Union. Puerto Rico, still crushed under its massive debt. Venezuela, still just a devastating, tragic story, still collapsing. And we'll be following all of those stories well into 2017. And, of course, we'll be covering our brand new president. But to wrap up this year, there are still a few podcasts that we wanted to check back in on. First up, Wells Fargo. We did two big investigations into the bank along with NPR economics correspondent Chris Arnold. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Robert.
So let's just quickly recap what we did in the two podcasts. What did Wells Fargo do wrong?
So, okay, there was this big banking scandal at Wells Fargo that people have probably heard of where like a million customers got credit cards and stuff that they didn't ask for, and that's terrible. But what we dug into and what I think is much more interesting is it was the employees themselves at this company who probably were hurt more than anyone else. And the way that happened is that we found a number of folks who resisted the sales pressure and the fraud and all the bad stuff that was going on inside the bank. Some of them even called the ethics line at the bank to say, hey, this is terrible. There's all this bad stuff going on around the office. And after they did that, they were either pushed out or fired. And then the bank did something very particular to them. It put what we call the scarlet letter on their permanent record. It's called a U5 is what the permanent record is called. And that prevented them from getting a job at any other bank. And so it just basically wrecked their career.
And we specifically told a story about a young man named Jeremy who had this scarlet letter on his U5 and essentially had to change the part of the banking industry he was in. And he knows this bad mark is still on his record.
I try not to think about it, to be honest with you, because it scares the crap out of me. Everything that I've worked for these past 8 years can be taken away from me because of this blemish, because of this lie, because of this one statement that Wells Fargo had put on there.
Yeah, so for him, he's basically saying, look, this is like a landmine that could go off at any time and destroy his career.
Yeah, a landmine planted by his former employer, by Wells Fargo.
Right, exactly. And so this caught the attention of a lot of people. We got a lot of feedback on this story. And in particular, this caught the attention of Senator Elizabeth Warren, who, as you probably know, is from Massachusetts. And she's made a name for herself, obviously, by challenging big, powerful financial institutions and trying to get reforms there. She is not somebody you want to have firing off letters to your CEO and demanding answers. And as a result of our stories, that's exactly what happened.
We heard the reports on NPR about former Wells employees who said that Wells Fargo had retaliated against them using statements on their U-5s that were not true and that hurt them. And that's what got us interested. And so we started looking at the U-5s, these statements that are required to be filed, and digging and finding more and more evidence of a big problem at Wells.
And Chris, when Senator Warren says she's looking into this, I mean, that really means she's conducting an investigation.
Right. She's asked for documents from FINRA, which is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. That sounds like a government agency. It's actually a self-regulatory industry group, but she's trying to get all kinds of documents from them.
They're the bank industry group that puts this mark on the U-5.
Right. They manage this whole U-5 system. So she's asking questions of FINRA. She sent a letter to Wells Fargo demanding answers and wanting more information. But she's making this bigger than Wells Fargo. She's asking the question, okay, wait, how could this happen? And the fact that this did happen, does that mean that we need some kind of reform here to fix the system?
We protect whistleblowers. When somebody says there's a problem here, you know, their employer doesn't get to attack them. Wells seems to have taken the attitude that if there's something wrong here, it's the whistleblower's problem.
We should say there has been a few other bits of progress after we aired the podcast. Wells Fargo has talked about at least intending to rehire some of the workers that perhaps were wrongly fired. We're following that. And FINRA has sort of at least acknowledged, Chris, that there might be a problem with these U-5, with these reports, with these black marks on people's records. We will definitely hear more about Wells Fargo in 2017. Thanks, Chris.
Oh, you're welcome.
It is my pleasure to bring in Jacob Goldstein to talk about a great podcast he did in the fall about self-checkout machines. These are these things that grocery stores have put in to, I don't know, to make my life easier?
Well, you scan your groceries yourself, and then it breaks, and they call over the store employee to fix it, and then you walk out of the grocery store.
Ooh, saves all this time and effort.
Yeah, that's the theory, anyway. So for this story, as you may recall, Nick Fountain and I, we went up to Toronto, we talked to the inventor of the self-checkout machine, and we also talked about the future of self-checkout. And for that part of the show, we talked to somebody named Dusty Lutz. He works at NCR. That's a big company that's working on this stuff. And Dusty Lutz, he described for us, like, his vision. He's like, this is the store of the future.
Do you even need the scanner? Could you actually not have more cameras and artificial intelligence behind the cameras that actually know that we just saw you pick an item up from this part of the shelf, and we know that that's where the baked beans are, and therefore automatically add that to your order. That's as frictionless as you can get. You walk in the store, you pick up your items, you walk out.
No cash register at all.
That's right.
And do you think that'll actually happen?
That will happen. Yeah, the question is, will that happen in 2020 or will that happen in 2030?
And all I get is baked beans, so this would solve all of my problems.
All you need is a store that sells baked beans without a cashier.
With lasers.
So this is, you know, the Dusty Lutz vision. But when you talk to tech people, they always have their, like, utopian vision of the future. And that, like, never really comes. So he says all this, and I'm skeptical. But Robert Smith, a mere 48 days, less than 2 months after this podcast aired, Amazon, as in Amazon.com, announced a new project.
Welcome to Amazon Go. Use the Amazon Go app to enter. Then put away your phone and start shopping. It's really that simple.
So, Robert, Amazon Go is a store. It's like a little 7-Eleven, and it works just like Dusty Lutz of NCR told us the store of the future would work.
Once you've got everything you want, you can just go. When you leave, our Just Walk Out technology adds up your virtual cart and charges your Amazon account. Your receipt is sent straight to the app, and you can keep going. Amazon Go. No lines, no checkout.
Yes, apparently what the store needed was not necessarily technology, but lots of buzzwords like just walk out technology.
And they're like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
It's inspiring. Do we know how they do it?
Amazon is glad you asked.
So how does it work? We used computer vision, deep learning algorithms, and sensor fusion, much like you'd find in self-driving cars.
I have no idea what that means.
I suspect there's a lot of workers on closed-circuit cameras just going like, he just took out two cans of beans.
I should say, let me just put one more note of skepticism, though my skepticism apparently just got proved wrong. But this is an ad. The store is not open yet, but it is supposed to be open in early 2017, a real store in Seattle, Washington.
Thank you, Jacob.
Sure, man. Happy New Year.
Our last check-in on the rest of the story is with Stacey Fanick Smith. Stacey.
Hi, Robert.
We did a podcast a year ago now that was about ISIS. And more specifically, it was about the economics of ISIS.
Yes. ISIS is, of course, the terrorist group that is occupying territory in Syria and Iraq. And we spoke with a man who lived in an ISIS-controlled town. His name was Mohammed Ketterer, and his hometown is Deir ez-Zor. And he told us a little bit about the economics of living in an ISIS-controlled town. He said ISIS members use dollars, and they have a lot of money to throw around. And stores in Deir ez-Zor started catering to them, selling a lot of really Western items, things like energy drinks and Axe body spray and candy bars.
Twix, that's kind of fancy goods.
Twix?
It's really Twix.
Like Twix bars? Like only ISIS fighters get to eat Twix bars?
Yes, because it's expensive.
One of the amazing things in this podcast was Mohammed's story. He had actually been recruited to work for ISIS.
Yes, to design a logo for their news agency.
Because he's a graphic designer.
Exactly. And after that, he was asked to join ISIS, and he fled. And when we talked to him, he was in Turkey. He's since left Turkey. He is now in Germany with his family, although he is still in touch with people in Deir ez-Zor, his hometown. And he said things there are mostly the same, but they have gotten worse. One of the things he said was that tax collecting has gotten more aggressive. And now ISIS is demanding taxes in this special currency that it mints.
Yeah, they used to demand a ton of taxes in either Syrian money or in U.S. dollars.
Exactly. But ISIS started making its own coins out of gold and silver and copper. And it sells these coins to jewelry stores, and people have to go to jewelry stores and buy them so that when ISIS members show up at their house demanding money, they can pay them in this special ISIS money. He said ISIS members themselves still use dollars, but everybody has to pay ISIS in these special coins.
So ISIS makes money by minting money, by selling it to the people, and then under threat of death, demands the money back from them in taxes.
Yes.
Evil genius.
Yeah, evil genius. Mohammed himself is doing pretty well. He has a new baby. He's trying to learn German, but he says he still misses Deir ez-Zor every day. And he says the second ISIS leaves, he and his family will go back.
Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, Robert.
No, no, no. Do not leave because I have a surprise caller for you on the line.
Okay.
Hello.
Jason?
Yes.
Hi, Jason.
Jason Bruns, the man
yes.
who sold us our oil.
Yes. How are you guys?
Good.
I should remind everyone listening, in 2016, Planet Money got into the oil business. We got into it hard. We bought 100 barrels of O. That's how we fancy oil people call it.
You're no laughing. One calls it O.
We got 100 barrels of oil at $40 a barrel.
And we lost a ton of money doing it. You should go back and listen if you have not had the chance. And when we last left you, Jason, you were standing in a muddy oil field with our money, if I remember right.
Where are you right now?
Phoenix, Arizona.
What are you doing in Phoenix?
Vacationing. We're just down here doing a lot of golfing and a lot of eating.
I suspect that this vacation was paid for by the Planet Money incompetence at buying oil.
Well, I don't think that quite got it. It did probably help me buy one of my steak dinners, though, I'm not going to lie. But it probably didn't do much on anything else.
A lot has happened in the oil world since we lost money and left the business. OPEC, the oil cartel, agreed to limit its production of oil, which sent the price shooting up. In fact, the same oil that we bought at $40 a barrel is now fetching $46 a barrel.
If we'd had a way to keep that oil, we could have made a huge profit.
We could have.
But of course, we did not. I mean, where would we have even put it?
If you had put it in bottles and sold it like a quart at a time on your show, you probably have done better.
Oh, you're right.
So, Jason, when we last left you, you had shut down one of your wells because of the low oil price.
Yes.
And you did not feel very good about that well.
No.
So.
No, I didn't, but I did start it up the next month. I started it up and ran it long enough to make it tank oil and to able to keep the lease. And you know, it wasn't profitable, so to say, but at least I broke even.
You told us that you did not sort of get up in the morning and check the price of oil. You didn't follow all the news because it was creating stress and anxiety for you. But that was when the price was going down. When the price is going up, are you more excited to check your phone, check the news, check the price every hour?
Oh, not every hour, but I check it every day.
It is still amazing to me how all these things in the world can affect the price of oil in Kansas. You know, an OPEC meeting in Geneva, or rumors about Donald Trump and how he's going to treat Iran more harshly, like that can determine whether or not you get to take a nice vacation or not. But I guess, you know, you're probably used to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My grandpa used to tell me, he said, one day you're ready to go buy a Cadillac and ready to go out for a steak dinner, and the next day you're ready to buy a Pinto and go out for a bologna sandwich. You know, that's the roller coaster ride of the oil business.
And you just went out for a steak dinner.
We just went out for a steak dinner last night. That's right. So we're encouraged.
All right. Enjoy your golf game.
Yes.
Thanks
good luck.
Bye bye.
Okay.
Yeah,
bye, Jason.
Jason Bruns, the true winner in the Planet Money oil project.
Somebody had to be.
We love to hear what you think of Planet Money, so you should email us maybe your favorite story from the past year, 2016. We are planetmoney@npr.org.
Today's episode, and in fact all of our episodes for the year, were produced by Sally Helm, Jess Jang, Nick Fountain, Elizabeth Koulas, and Alex Goldmark. You guys are the best. Thank you. If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, maybe you need a little break from family time, check out some of the other podcasts from NPR, Embedded, How I Built This, Invisibilia, Code Switch. They're all great, and you can find them at npr.org/podcasts or on the NPR One app.
I'm Robert Smith.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And we should note, we are not married. Like, you want to know the rest of the story? The rest of the story is we're both Smiths, but we're not married. There's a lot of Smiths in the world. So stop writing to ask if we're married. We're not married.
Well, it's interesting because my aunt back in Idaho actually sent me a text message because when you Google my name, the first thing that comes up is Stacey Vanek Smith married, then Stacey Vanek Smith wedding, then Stacey Vanek Smith married Robert Smith. And so my aunt Googled me and thought that I had like secretly gotten married. And apparently this was like the talk around the Smith family.
We're not married.
We're not married.
So do not assume. And in fact, we want to do a favor for Stacey Vanek Smith, no relation. We want to do a favor for Stacey, which is go to your Google and I want you to search Stacey Vanek Smith, genius.
I like that.
Stacey Vanek Smith, awesome reporter.
I also like that.
Stacey Vanek Smith, can she fly?
Good question. I've never tried.
It doesn't matter. Whatever you do, do not Google if we are married, because we are not.
I would love it if my aunt calls me in 2017 to say, Stacey, the whole family's talking about whether or not you can fly. That would be awesome.
Thanks for listening.